print a separate sheet with suggested combinations, lest one starve from befuddlement. Passengers drank and smoked. Both. A lot. This was a significant source of profit for Cunard. The company laid in a supply of 150 cases of black and white whiskey, 50 cases of Canadian club whiskey, and 50 of Plymouth gin. Also, 15 cases each of an 11-year-old French red wine, a Chambertin, and an 11-year-old French white, a Chablis, and 12 barrels of stout and 10 of ale. Cunard stockpiled 30,000 Three Castles cigarettes and 10,000 Manila cigars. The ship also sold cigars from Havana and American cigarettes made by Philip Morris. For the many passengers who brought pipes, Cunard acquired 560 pounds of loose capstan tobacco, Navy Cut, and 200 pounds of Lord Nelson Flake, both in 4-ounce tins. Passengers also brought their own. Michael Byrne, a retired New York merchant and former deputy sheriff traveling in first class, apparently planned to spend a good deal of the voyage smoking. He packed 11 pounds of Old Rover tobacco and 300 cigars. During the voyage, the scent of combusted tobacco was ever present, especially after dinner. The dominant topic of conversation, according to passenger Harold Smethurst, was war and submarines. For Theodate Pope, there was tedium, but also depression. Ever since childhood, she had struggled with it. Theodate described herself once as being afflicted with over-consciousness. During her time at Miss Porter's school in Farmington, she had often become depressed and was hobbled by fatigue. In 1887, when she was 20, she wrote in her diary, "Tears come without any provocation. Headache all day." The school's headmistress and founder, Sarah Porter, offered therapeutic counsel. "Cheer up," she told Theodate. "Always be happy." It did not work. The next year, in March 1888, her parents sent her to Philadelphia to be examined and cared for by Dr. Silas Weir Mitchell, a physician famous for treating patients, mainly women, suffering from neurasthenia or nervous exhaustion. Mitchell's solution for Theodate was his then-famous rest cure, a period of forced inactivity lasting up to 2 months. "At first, and in some cases for 4 or 5 weeks, I do not permit the patient to sit up or to sew or write or read," Mitchell wrote in his book, Fat and Blood. "The only action allowed is that needed to clean the teeth." He forbade some patients from rolling over on their own, insisting they do so only with the help of a nurse. "In such cases, I arrange to have the bowels and water passed while lying down, and the patient is lifted onto a lounge at bedtime and sponged, and then lifted back again into the newly made bed. For stubborn cases, he reserved mild electrical shock, delivered while the patient was in a filled bathtub." His method reflected his own dim view of women. In his book, Wear and Tear, or Hints for the Overworked, he wrote that women would do far better if the brain were very lightly tasked. Theodate complied with the rules of Mitchell's rest cure, even though she believed rest to be the last thing she needed. She wrote, "I am always happy when I keep so busy that I cannot stop to think of the sadness of life." The cure didn't help. And in fact, Dr. Mitchell's approach was soon to undergo a nationwide reevaluation. In 1892, a writer named Charlotte Perkins Gilman published a popular short story, The Yellow Wallpaper, in which she attacked Mitchell's rest cure. Gilman had become a patient of his in 1887, a year before Theodate's treatment, suffering from what a later generation would describe as postpartum depression. Gilman spent a month at Dr. Mitchell's clinic. Afterward, he He wrote out a prescription for how she was to proceed after treatment. Live as domestic a life as possible. Have your child with you all the time. Lie down an hour after each meal. Have but 2 hours intellectual life a day. And this, never touch pen, brush, or pencil again as long as you live. Gilman claimed that Mitchell's cure drove her to the edge of insanity. She wrote the story, she said, to warn would-be patients of the dangers of this doctor who so nearly drove me mad. Theodate continued fighting depression throughout her 30s. By the autumn of 1900, when she was 33, it threatened even to deaden her love of art and architecture. I find that my material world is losing its power to please or harm me. It is not vital to me anymore, she wrote in her diary. I am turning in on myself and am finding my pleasure in the inner world, which was my constant retreat when I was a child. Even her interest in paintings began to wane. She wrote, pictures have been dead long ago to me. The ones that please me only at first sight. After that, they are paint and nothing more. To use a vulgar expression, sucked lemons. Architecture continued to engage her, but with less ferocity. My interest in architecture has always been more intense than my interest in any other art manifestation, and on my word, I think it is not dead yet. Not quite. She was, she wrote, tired of seeing these fluted, flimsy, highly colored hen houses going up, and am gnashing my teeth over them. She and Edwin Friend dined together, and at least for a time shared their table with a young doctor from Saratoga Springs, New York, named James Houghton, and with one of the ship's more famous personages, Marie Depage, a nurse who, along with her physician husband, Antoine, had gained fame for tending Belgians wounded in the war. Depage had spent the previous 2 months raising money to support their work, but was now on her way back to Europe to see her son Lucien before he was sent to the front. Dr. Houghton, en route to Belgium to help Depage's husband, at one point revealed that on the night before the Lusitania's departure, he had signed a new will. Such talk did not move Theodate. She wrote, I truly believe there was no one on the ship who valued life as little as I do. Margaret Mackworth and her father, D.A. Thomas, were seated at a table in the first-class dining room with an American doctor and his sister-in-law, Dorothy Connor, 25, from Medford, Oregon. Connor was a woman of energy and candor. She was also bored and given to impetuous remarks. At one point, Connor said, I can't help hoping that we get some sort of thrill going up the channel. Margaret took note of the curiously high number of children on the passenger list. We noticed this with much surprise, she wrote. She attributed this to families moving from Canada to England to be near husbands and fathers fighting in the war. She took the German embassy's warning seriously and told herself that in case of trouble she would have to override her instinct to run immediately to the boat deck, and instead go first to her cabin and get her life jacket. Preston Pritchard, the young medical student heading home from Canada, found himself seated at a long table in the second-class dining hall directly opposite a young woman named Grace French of Renton, England, who was among those passengers transferred to the ship from the Cameronia. She seemed to take an interest in Pritchard, or at least found him worth examining in some detail. She saw that he had a narrow tie with a red stripe, and she paid close enough attention to realize that he had only 2 suits, one very smart navy blue serge and a green suit, more for knockabout wear. She also noted his lava head tie clasp. About the heads, I remember them distinctly, because my father once had ones similar, and they took my eye, and so far as I can remember, he wore it all the time. Pritchard was kind and funny and full of stories, and very good-looking. He kept us in good spirits, relating different experiences he had during his travels, and was very nice to everybody, she wrote. I appreciated his efforts, as I was very sick, seasick, during the whole journey, and he was especially nice to me. She also took note of the lucky young woman, also English, who'd been assigned the seat right next to Pritchard. With a whiff of a meow, Miss French described this potential rival as very short, with light brown hair, blue eyes, lots of color in her face, and I think she was visiting in California. At least she talked a great deal about its beauties and advantage. She added, they were great friends at the dining table. In addition to playing whist, Pritchard took part in the mileage betting pools and in various deck sports, including tug-of-war and an improvised obstacle course. A party of us used to have a game of skipping every day, one young woman recalled. At a certain point, another participant, a young man, tried to use the jump rope to lasso her, but failed. Pritchard stepped forward and showed the group how to do it. He seemed to be an expert at lassoing and roped many of the players. I never saw him again after this, the woman said. She touched on a peculiar aspect of life aboard such a large ship. You might meet someone who interested you in one way or another, but unless that person happened to be assigned to your table or your room, or occupied the deck chair next to yours, you had little opportunity to build a closer association. The ship was too big. Gertrude Adams, a passenger in second class traveling with her 2.5-year-old daughter, wrote later, there were so many on the ship that it really was like living in a town. One saw fresh people every day and never knew who they were. It was a mark of Pritchard's popularity that so many casual acquaintances remembered him at all. In the evening, select guests would be invited to sit at a table presided over by Staff Captain Anderson, or at Captain Turner's table, on those occasions when Turner was willing to suppress his antipathy toward social engagement. As a rule, he preferred to take his meals in his cabin or on the bridge. He was particularly fond of chicken, and during one meal drove his first officer nearly mad with his effort to gnaw every last morsel off a chicken leg. U-20. The Trouble with Torpedoes. Early on Monday morning, U-20 was sailing through a world of cobalt and cantaloupe. Very beautiful weather, Schwieger noted in a 4 a.m. entry in his log. The boat was abreast of Sewell Skerry, a small island west of the Orkneys with an 88-foot lighthouse, said to be the most remote and isolated light in the British Isles. Schwieger sailed a southwesterly course. He saw no targets, but also no threats, and was able to stay on the surface the entire day. Toward nightfall, at 6:50 p.m., he at last spotted a potential target, a steamer of about 2,000 tons. It flew a Danish flag off its stern, but Schwieger's war pilot, Lance, believed the flag was a ruse, that the ship was in fact a British vessel out of Edinburgh. It was heading toward U-20. Schwieger ordered a fast dive to periscope depth. Now began the complex choreography that would determine whether he could add this ship to his personal tally of sunk tonnage. Men ran back and forth under the direction of the ship's chief engineer to help keep the boat level as the helmsman adjusted the horizontal and vertical planes. Schwieger raised and lowered the periscope at brief intervals to keep the steamer in sight, but minimized the amount of time the periscope and its wake were visible on the surface. With his rangefinder, Schwieger gauged the ship's distance and speed. Another indicator of velocity was the height to which water rose on the target's bow. The higher and wider, the faster. If this had been a French battleship, Schwieger would have had to watch especially closely, for the French Navy painted false wakes on the bows of its warships in an effort to confuse the calculations of U-boat commanders. Schwieger had two kinds of torpedoes aboard, an old bronze model and the newest G6 torpedoes. The G6, or gyro, torpedo was bigger and more reliable, but Schwieger selected one of the bronze models, presumably in order to conserve the better torpedoes for more important targets, like the troop transports he would be hunting in Liverpool Bay. The crew armed it and flooded its launching tube, one of the two tubes in U-20's bow. The boat had two others in its stern. The men at the hydroplanes worked to keep the boat as steady and level as possible, lest the conning tower rise too high and betray the submarine's presence, or the periscope sink below the surface and make aiming impossible. The freighter approached, clearly unaware that U-20 was ahead. Schwieger positioned his boat at a right angle to the ship's course and advanced slowly to maintain steerage, just enough forward motion to keep the hydroplanes and rudder engaged. The submarine was, in effect, a gun barrel, and had to be pointed in the right direction at the time the torpedo was launched. From the bow, a crewman called, "Torpedo ready!" Torpedoes were weapons of great power, when they worked. Schwieger distrusted them, and with good reason. According to a German tally, 60% of attempted torpedo firings resulted in failure. Torpedoes veered off course. They traveled too deep and passed under their targets. Their triggers broke. Their warheads failed to explode. Aiming them was an art. Through the restricted view afforded by the periscope, a captain had to estimate the forward speed of the target, its course, and its distance away. He aimed not at the target itself, but at a point well ahead, as if shooting skeet. Stories of torpedo mishaps were rife among crews. One U-boat experienced 3 torpedo failures in 24 hours. In the third of these, the torpedo turned unexpectedly and traveled in a circle back toward the boat and nearly hit it. Another submarine, UB-109, of a class used primarily for coastal patrols, tried launching an attack while surfaced. The first torpedo, fired from its stern, left the tube and immediately sank. The captain maneuvered the boat so that he could take another shot, this time from the bow. But according to a British intelligence report, this torpedo broke surface 5 or 6 times, described a complete circle, and also missed the target. Torpedoes were expensive and heavy. Each cost up to $5,000, over $100,000 today, and weighed over 3,000 pounds, twice the weight of a Ford Model T. Schwieger's boat had room only for 7, 2 of which were to be held in reserve for the homeward voyage. If the performance measured by the German Navy were to hold true for Schwieger on this patrol, it would mean that if he fired all 7 of his torpedoes, only 3 would succeed in striking a ship and exploding. Schwieger's target, the presumed British ship flying Danish colors, continued its approach. It was 300 meters away, the U-boat equivalent of point-blank range, when Schwieger gave the order to fire. The command was repeated throughout the boat. What should have come next was a whoosh and a tremor as the torpedo left its tube, followed by a sudden, perceptible rise of the bow due to the lost weight, this immediately suppressed by the men at the hydroplanes. But Schwieger heard nothing and felt nothing. There was only silence. The torpedo never left the tube. A misfire. A locking mechanism had failed to release. The target continued on its way into the safe, deep waters of the North Atlantic, its crew apparently unaware of how close they had come to disaster. Lusitania, sunshine and happiness. William Mary Heine of General Motors. Tuesday, resumption of games on deck today. Dandy sunshine weather. Nellie Houston, 31, second class, heading home to England. Tuesday, I didn't write a letter each day, you will notice. On Saturday night, after I'd written to you, I went to bed and had a fine night. I've got the top bunk, and really, I don't know if I was supposed to be able to spring right into it, but I tried and couldn't, so I had to ring for the steward to bring me some steps. They seemed to be short of everything, so I had to wait quite a while. He tried to persuade me to jump in, but I'm too heavy behind. Jane McFarquhar of Stratford, Connecticut, traveling with her daughter Grace, 16, second class. I think a happier company of passengers would be impossible to find. They were of all ages, a large number of babies in their mother's arms, children of various ages, and men and women up to the age of 70. Games were heartily enjoyed on the decks during the daytime, and concerts were enjoyed in the evenings. Sunshine and happiness, making thoughts of danger almost impossible. Charles Laureate. As the days passed, the passengers seemed to enjoy them more and more, and formed those acquaintances such as one does on an ocean crossing. Dorothy Connor, 25, of Medford, Oregon, in first class. I'd never seen a more uneventful or stupid voyage. Room 40. The Orion sails. On Tuesday, May 4th, the Admiralty decided it could no longer hold the HMS Orion at Devonport, but took precautions to make sure the Super Dreadnought made it safely to the fleet's base at Scapa Flow. Admiral Oliver ordered the ship to depart that night, under cover of darkness, and gave strict instructions that it sail 50 miles west, past the Scilly Islands, before turning north, and then keep at least 100 miles out to sea for the remainder of the voyage up the Irish coast. He also assigned four destroyers, HMS Laertes, Morsum, Mings, and Boyne, to provide an escort until the Orion reached deep ocean. A succession of reports to the Admiralty provided a step-by-step account of the Orion's progress, including changes in speed. It was the most closely watched ship on the high seas. The Admiralty's telegraphic records show no reference made at all to the Lusitania, by now 4 days into its voyage, and halfway across the Atlantic. In London, at the Admiralty's war room, messages arrived reporting fresh submarine sightings and new attacks. On the morning of Sunday, May 2nd, a French ship, the Europe, was torpedoed and sunk off the Scillies. A lighthouse keeper elsewhere reported spotting a steamer chased by submarine. An Admiralty collier, the Fulgent, was torpedoed off the Skelling Rocks west of Ireland. 9 members of its crew were rescued and landed at Galway on Monday evening. Early on the morning of Tuesday, May 4th, an observer reported spotting a submarine on the surface northwest of Frenchman's Rock in the Scillies. He watched it move east, then dive. That same morning, at 3:15 a.m., a coast watcher reported a large sheet of flame rising from the sea off County Mayo. But in Room 40, Commander Hope and his codebreakers heard nothing new from Kapitänleutnant Walter Schwieger. The submarine was too far from Germany to attempt wireless communication. Room 40 could only presume that Schwieger was still on his way to his patrol zone in the Irish Sea. It was a curious moment in the history of naval warfare. Room 40 knew a U-boat was heading south to Liverpool, knew the boat's history, knew that it was now somewhere in the North Atlantic under orders to sink troop transports and any other British vessel it encountered, and knew as well that the submarine was armed with enough shells and torpedoes to sink a dozen ships. It was like knowing that a particular killer was loose on the streets of London, armed with a particular weapon, and certain to strike in a particular neighborhood within the next few days, the only unknown being exactly when. The quiet meant nothing. At some point, U-20 would make its presence known. U-20. Frustration. At 7:40 p.m. Tuesday, Schwieger at last sighted the coast of Ireland. A lighthouse lay on the horizon, barely visible in the rising mist. The day had been a disappointment. Strong swells had made the going uncomfortable for the crew below, and Schwieger had found no targets worthy of attack. An armed trawler briefly had come into view, but he realized its draft was so shallow that a torpedo would likely run underneath its keel. Visibility had been poor for most of the day, though by evening it improved to the point where he could see distant objects. The gathering haze, however, foretold a night of fog. 15 minutes later, a steamship appeared, heading in U-20's direction. It was still far off, but looked to be a vessel of significant tonnage. Schwieger ordered a dive to periscope depth and prepared his attack. He placed U-20 at a 90-degree angle to the ship's course to set up what he called a clean bow shot, and once again selected a bronze torpedo. As the ship approached, however, it seemed to shrink in size. Something about the fading light and mist had produced an optical illusion that made the vessel at first look large, but the closer it got, the smaller it got. Schwieger estimated its tonnage at a mere 1,500 tons. Still, it was something. He maneuvered so that when the ship's course intersected his, he would be just 300 meters away. The target was still a mile off. And then, as he watched through the periscope, the ship sheered from its course. At that distance, there was no chance for him to catch up. Even in the spare prose of his log, Schwieger's frustration was evident. "It was impossible that the steamer could have seen us," he wrote. He identified the ship as a Swedish vessel, the Hibernia, with neutral signs, without flag. Schwieger brought U-20 back to the surface and continued south through a night he described as being exceptionally dark. London, Berlin, Washington. Comfort denied. On that Wednesday, May 5th, Britain's top naval official, Winston Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty, left London for Paris. He could do so with relative safety because a combination of protective measures, sea mines and submarine nets at the eastern end of the English Channel and heavy patrols along its length, had made the channel too dangerous for submarines to traverse on a routine basis. Although Churchill traveled incognito and checked into his hotel under a false name, there was little mystery about his visit. He was to meet with Italian and French officials to determine how the Italian navy should be used in the Mediterranean Sea, now that Italy, on April 26th, had joined the war on the side of Britain, France, and Russia. Afterward, as he had done on previous occasions, Churchill planned to travel to the front to spend time with Field Marshal Sir John French, Sir John Denton Pinkstone French, commander of the British Expeditionary Force in France. With Churchill absent, the Admiralty became a much quieter place. Ordinarily, he kept a very close hand on naval matters, including details of day-to-day operations that, at least in theory, were supposed to be left to the number two Admiralty official, the First Sea Lord. This put the 40-year-old Churchill in direct conflict with the 74-year-old occupant of that post, Admiral Jackie Fisher. If Churchill resembled a bulldog, Fisher was a large, bulb-eyed toad, dead ringer for a future actor named Laszlo Lowenstein, better known by the stage name Peter Lorre. Like Churchill, Fisher was strong-willed and tended to consume himself with the minute details of naval operations. When both men were present, tension was the order of the day. One naval official wrote to his wife, "The situation is curious. Two very strong and clever men, one old, wily, and of vast experience, one young, self-assertive, with a great self-satisfaction, but unstable. They cannot work together. They cannot both run the show." Churchill seemed bent on usurping Fisher's role. Churchill's energy and capacity for work were almost frightening, wrote Intelligence Chief Blinker Hall. Notes and memoranda on every conceivable subject would stream forth from his room at all hours of the day and night. What was worse, he would demand information which would ordinarily and properly have gone only to the First Sea Lord or Chief of Staff, a fact which more than once led to some confusion and an unmerited word of rebuke. What made their relationship still more turbulent was the fact that Fisher seemed to be tottering on the verge of madness. Wrote Hall, "Gradually we in the Admiralty could not help becoming aware that the Fisher we had known was no longer with us. In his place was a sorely harassed and disillusioned man who was overtaxing his strength in the attempt to carry on. He might still on occasion show the old flashes of brilliance, but beneath the surface, all was far from being well. At any moment, we felt, the breaking point would come." Admiral Jellicoe, commander of the Grand Fleet, likewise grew concerned. "The state of affairs at headquarters," he wrote in an April 26th letter to a fellow officer, "is as bad or worse than I feared. It is lamentable that things should be as they are, and there is no doubt whatever that the fleet is rapidly losing confidence in the administration." Churchill acknowledged Fisher's energy and prior genius. "But he was 74 years old," Churchill wrote, in an oblique evisceration. "As in a great castle which has long contended with time, the mighty central mass of the dungeon towered up intact and seemingly everlasting. But the outworks and the battlements had fallen away, and its imperious ruler dwelt only in the special apartments and corridors with which he had a lifelong familiarity." This, however, was exactly what Churchill had hoped for in bringing Fisher back as First Sea Lord. "I took him because I knew he was old and weak, and that I should be able to keep things in my own hands." By May 1915, Churchill wrote, Fisher was suffering from great nervous exhaustion. With Churchill gone to Paris, Fisher was in charge and seemed barely up to the task. He had evinced unconcealed distress and anxiety at being left alone in sole charge of the Admiralty, Churchill wrote. "There is no doubt that the old Admiral was worried almost out of his wits by the immense pressure of the times and by the course events had taken." In Churchill's absence, an incident took place that seemed to reinforce his concerns about Fisher's sanity. Before leaving for France, Churchill had told his wife Clementine, "Just look after the old boy for me." And so Clementine invited Fisher to come to lunch. She neither liked nor trusted Fisher, and doubted he could withstand the stress of having to run the Admiralty in her husband's absence. The lunch went well, however, and Fisher departed. Or so Clementine thought. Soon afterward, she too left the sitting room, and found that Fisher was still in the house, lurking in the passage, according to an account by the Churchill's daughter Mary. Clementine was startled, Mary recalled. She asked him what he wanted, whereupon, in a brusque and somewhat incoherent manner, he told her that while she no doubt was under the impression that Winston was conferring with Sir John French, He was, in fact, frolicking with a mistress in Paris. To Clementine, this was a ludicrous charge. She snapped, "Be quiet, you silly old man, and get out." With Churchill in Paris, the torrent of notes and telegrams he generated daily, the constant bombardment of memoranda and minutes on every conceivable subject, technical or otherwise, as Fisher's assistant described it, abruptly subsided. Relative to the turmoil that ordinarily existed in its halls, the Admiralty now became quiescent, if not to say inattentive. At the U.S. Embassy in Berlin, Ambassador James W. Gerard received a curt two-paragraph note from the German Foreign Office. The message, dated Wednesday, May 5th, cited the fact that in preceding weeks, it has repeatedly occurred that neutral ships had been sunk by German submarines in the designated war zone. In one case, the note said, a U-boat sank a neutral ship on account of the inadequate illumination of its neutral markings in the darkness. The note urged Gerard to convey these facts to Washington and to recommend that the United States again warn American shipping circles against traversing the war zone without taking due precautions. Ships, the note said, should be sure to make their neutral markings as plain as possible, and especially to have them illuminated promptly at nightfall and throughout the night. Gerard relayed this to the State Department the next day. In Washington, President Wilson found himself in emotional turmoil for reasons unrelated to ships and war. By now he had fallen ever more deeply in love with Edith Galt, and with the prospect of no longer being alone. On the evening of Tuesday, May 4th, Wilson sent his Pierce Arrow to pick up Edith and bring her to the White House for dinner. She wore a white satin gown with creamy lace and just a touch of emerald green velvet at the edge of the deep square neck and green slippers to match, she recalled. Afterward, Wilson led her out onto the south portico, where they sat by themselves, without chaperone. The evening was warm, the air fragrant with the rich perfume of a Washington spring. He told her he loved her. She was stunned. "Oh, you can't love me," she said, "for you don't really know me, and it is less than a year since your wife died." Wilson, unfazed, said, "I was afraid, knowing you, that I would shock you," he said, "but I would be less than a gentleman if I continued to make opportunities to see you without telling you what I have told my daughters and Helen, that I want you to be my wife." So, not just love, itself a striking declaration, but marriage. Edith turned him down. She leavened her rejection with a note she composed later that night after Wilson dropped her at her apartment. "It is long past midnight," she wrote early Wednesday morning, May 5th. "I have been sitting in the big chair by the window, looking out into the night ever since you went away. My whole being is awake and vibrant." She told him that his expression of love and confession of loneliness had left her anguished. "How I want to help. What an unspeakable pleasure and privilege I deem it to be allowed to share these tense, terrible days of responsibility. How I thrill to my very fingertips when I remember the tremendous thing you said to me tonight, and how pitifully poor I am to have nothing to offer you in return. Nothing, I mean, in proportion to your own great gift." Here she joined the universal struggle shared by men and women throughout time to temper rejection so as not to lose a friend forever. "I am a woman, and the thought that you have need of me is sweet," she wrote. "But, dear kindred spirit, can you not trust me and let me lead you from the thought that you have forfeited anything by your fearless honesty to the conviction that, with such frankness between us, There is nothing to fear. We will help and hearten each other." She added, "You have been honest with me, and perhaps I was too frank with you. But if so, forgive me." Later that morning, with the sun up and the day underway, Edith and Helen Bones went for another walk in Rock Creek Park. They sat on some rocks to rest. Helen glared at Edith and said, "Cousin Woodrow looks really ill this morning." Helen loved her cousin and was protective of him. She nicknamed him Tiger, not because of some lascivious bent, but because, as Edith later told the story, he was so pathetic caged there in the White House, longing to come and go as she did, that he reminded her of a splendid Bengal tiger she had once seen, never still, moving, restless, resentful of his bars that shut out the larger life God had made for him. Now, in the park, Helen burst into tears. "Just as I thought some happiness was coming into his life," she said, "and now you are breaking his heart." In a strangely cinematic intervention, Dr. Grayson suddenly appeared from a nearby stand of trees riding a horse, a large white horse, no less. He asked Helen what had happened, and she quickly answered that she had tripped and fallen. "I don't think he believed her," Edith wrote, "but he pretended to and rode on." "His arrival was a timely thing," she added, "for I was starting to feel like a criminal and guilty of base ingratitude." She tried to explain to Helen that she wasn't being an ogre. Rather, she simply could not consent to something I did not feel. She told Helen that she understood she was playing with fire where Wilson was concerned, for his whole nature was intense and did not willingly wait, but that I must have time, really, to know my own heart. Edith's rejection caused Wilson great sorrow and left him feeling almost disoriented as world events clamored for his attention. Even Britain had become a growing source of irritation. In its drive to halt the flow of war materiel to Germany, British warships had stopped American ships and seized American cargoes. Early in the war, Wilson had grown concerned that Britain's actions might so outrage the American public as to cause serious conflict between the two nations. Diplomacy eased tensions for a time. But then on March 11, 1915, in response to Germany's war zone declaration of the preceding month, the British government issued a new and startling Order in Council, proclaiming its formal intent to stop every ship sailing to or from Germany, whether neutral or not, and to stop ships bound even for neutral ports, to determine whether their cargoes might ultimately end up in German hands. Britain also sharply increased the list of products it would henceforth view as contraband. The order outraged Wilson, who sent a formal protest in which he described Britain's plan as an almost unqualified denial of the sovereign rights of the nations now at peace. The note achieved nothing. Complaints poured in from American shippers whose cargoes had been detained or confiscated, although the State Department did succeed in securing the prompt release of an automobile shipped by an American socialite. For the British, the stakes were simply too high to allow compromise. As Britain's ambassador to America, Cecil Spring Rice, had written the previous fall, "In the life and death struggle in which we are now engaged, it is essential to prevent war supplies reaching the German armies and factories." America's neutrality seemed harder and harder to maintain. In a letter to a female friend, Mary Hulbert, Wilson wrote, "Together, England and Germany are likely to drive us crazy, because it looks oftentimes as if they were crazy themselves, the unnecessary provocations they invent." Still, Wilson recognized the fundamental difference that existed between how the two sides executed their campaigns against merchant traffic. The Royal Navy behaved in civil fashion and often paid for the contraband it seized. Germany, on the other hand, seemed increasingly willing to sink merchant ships without warning, even those bearing neutral markings. The torpedo attack on the Gulf Light was a case in point. Within the State Department, Undersecretary Robert Lansing warned that in light of the Gulf Light attack, the United States was duty-bound to adhere to Wilson's February declaration, vowing to hold Germany to a strict accountability for its actions. Wilson made no public comment, but he and Secretary of State Bryan, in background conversations with reporters, signaled that the administration would treat the incident in judicious fashion. No formal diplomatic action will be taken by the United States government until all the facts have been ascertained and a determination reached, the New York Times reported in a front-page story on Wednesday, May 5th. In fact, Wilson found the Gulf Light incident disquieting. This was an American ship. The attack had killed three men. What's more, it had occurred without warning. While the incident didn't strike Wilson as having the magnitude to draw the nation into war, it did demand some kind of protest. That Wednesday, he cabled his friend Colonel House, still in London, to ask his advice on what kind of response to send to Germany. House recommended a sharp note, but added, "I am afraid a more serious breach may at any time occur, for they seem to have no regard for consequences." Lusitania, the Manifest. Aboard the Lusitania, the Cunard Daily Bulletin kept passengers abreast of war news, but, like its counterparts on land, reported only broad movements of forces, as if war were a game played with tiles and dice, not flesh-and-blood men. These reports did not begin to capture the reality of the fighting then unfolding on the ground, particularly in the Dardanelles, where the Allied naval and ground offensive had stalled, and British and French forces had dug trenches that mimicked those on the Western Front. The most terrifying part of battle was the exit from a trench, standing up and climbing out, knowing that the opposing force would at that moment unleash a fusillade that would continue until the offensive concluded, either with victory, meaning a few yards gained, or defeat, a few yards lost, but invariably with half one's battalion dead, wounded, or missing. "I shall never forget the moment when we had to leave the shelter of the trenches," wrote British Private Ridley Sheldon of combat at Helles at the southwest tip of the Gallipoli Peninsula. "It is indeed terrible, the first step you take, right into the face of the most deadly fire, and to realize that any moment you may be shot down. But if you are not hit, then you seem to gather courage. And when you see on either side of you men like yourself, it inspires you with the determination to press forward. Away we went over the parapet with fixed bayonets, one line of us like the wind. But it was absolute murder, for men fell like corn before the sickle." The wounded lay in the open or in shell holes awaiting stretcher bearers who might not come for hours or even days. Injuries ranged from minor penetrations by shrapnel to grotesque disfigurements. "I got back into the trench and saw what I had not seen before, for the smoke had cleared now," wrote Captain Albert Muir, also on Helles. "A shell had just landed in his trench, in the spot where moments earlier he had been writing messages to be delivered by two orderlies. One orderly survived, the other did not. His body and his head lay 4 or 5 feet apart. Two of my signalers were killed also, and mutilated so horribly that to describe their condition would be inexcusable." Elsewhere at Helles, Sergeant Dennis Moriarty and his 1st Royal Munster Fusiliers fought off a Turkish assault that began at 10 o'clock at night. They crept right up to our trenches. They were in thousands, and they made the night hideous with yells and shouting, "Allah, Allah!" We could not help mowing them down. Some managed to reach Moriarty's trench. When the Turks got to close quarters, the devils used hand grenades, and you could only recognize our dead by their identity discs. My God, what a sight met us when day broke this morning. By the time the Allied invading force would finally be evacuated, in January 1916, some 265,000 Allied troops and 300,000 Turks would be dead, wounded, or missing. Men in the ships massed offshore fared little better. The armada was an impressive one, hundreds of vessels, ranging from minesweepers to giant dreadnoughts. But many were in easy range of Turkish artillery embedded in high ground, which dropped thousands of tons of high explosives onto their decks. The French battleship Suffren was struck by a shell that destroyed a gun turret and ignited a fire deep within its hull. Another shell destroyed its forward funnel. Rear Admiral Emil Guebrant descended from the bridge to survey the damage and bolster the morale of his sailors. The scene, he wrote, was tragically macabre. The image of desolation, the flames, spared nothing. As for our young men, a few minutes ago, so alert, so self-confident, all now lay dead on the bare deck, blackened, burnt skeletons, twisted in all directions, no trace of any clothing, the fire having devoured all. Aboard the Lusitania, there was quiet. There were books, and cigars, and fine foods, afternoon tea, and the easy cadence of shipboard life. Strolling the deck, chatting at the rails, doing crochet, and just sitting still in a deck chair in the sea breeze. Now and then, a ship appeared in the distance. Closer at hand, Wales. Back in New York, on Wednesday, May 5th, Cunard at last provided the customs office with the Lusitania's full cargo manifest. Unlike the initial one-page version filed by Captain Turner before departure, this supplemental manifest was 24 pages long and listed over 300 consignments. Here were muskrat skins, nuts, beeswax, bacon, salt brick, dental goods, cases of lard, and barrels of beef tongues, machinery from the Otis Elevator Company, and enough candy, 157 barrels of it, to populate the fantasies of all the school children in Liverpool. The manifest also listed one case of oil paintings, these accompanying first-class passenger Sir Hugh Lane, a Dublin art collector. To identify this consignment merely as oil paintings was an understatement. The paintings were insured for $4 million, about $92 million today, and were rumored to have included works by Rubens, Monet, Titian, and Rembrandt. More problematic, but entirely legal under U.S. neutrality laws, were the 50 barrels and 94 cases of aluminum powder and 50 cases of bronze powder, both highly flammable under certain conditions, as well as 1,250 cases of shrapnel-laden artillery shells made by the Bethlehem Steel Company, bound for the British Army and badly needed on the Western Front, where British forces were hampered by a severe shortage of artillery ammunition. Wrote Churchill, "The army in France was firing away shells at a rate which no military administration had ever been asked to sustain." The shrapnel shells were essentially inert. They contained only a minimum bursting charge. Their associated fuses were packed separately and stored elsewhere. The cartridges that held the powerful explosives needed to propel the shells from a gun were not among the ship's cargo. These would be attached later at an arsenal in Britain. Also aboard, according to the manifest, were 4,200 cases of Remington rifle ammunition, amounting to 170 tons. U-20. At last. Throughout the morning of Wednesday, May 5th, heavy fog lingered over the sea off Ireland. From 4 a.m. on, every time Schwieger checked on the weather through his periscope, all he saw was a dark opacity. He held U-20 on a southerly course and kept its speed slow, probably about 5 knots, to conserve battery power. At 8:25 a.m., Schwieger gauged visibility as good enough to bring the boat to the surface, though banks of fog persisted all around him. His crew now decoupled the two electric engines and engaged the diesels to bring U-20 to cruising speed and recharge the batteries. Somewhere off to his left, in the murk, was the southwest coast of Ireland, here a phalanx of stone cliffs jutting into the North Atlantic. He would soon pass Valentia Island, where the British had built a powerful wireless transmitter. Schwieger's own wireless man would by now be picking up strong signals from the Valentia Tower, but could not read the codes in which they were sent. U-20 moved through curtains of fog. By 12:50 p.m., Schwieger believed himself to be abreast of the Fastnet Rock, though he could not see it. The rock was one of Britain's most prominent maritime landmarks, a road sign to the western approaches. Irish immigrants in the 19th century knew it as Ireland's Teardrop because it was the last bit of Ireland they saw before their ships entered the North Atlantic en route to America. Here Schwieger ordered a left turn to begin sailing along Ireland's south coast toward Liverpool. This was the upper edge of a great funnel of ocean called the Celtic Sea, where inbound ships converged from north, west, and south. It was the perfect hunting ground for a U-boat. But Schwieger saw nothing. He wrote, "During the whole afternoon, no steamer sighted in spite of the clearing weather, although we found ourselves within one of the main shipping lanes." Visibility improved. Soon Schwieger was able to see the Irish coast, but only for a few moments. Over the next 3 hours, U-20 cruised on the surface and encountered no ships of any kind. The evening haze began to gather once again. Just before 5 o'clock, while off the coast of County Cork, Schwieger spotted what at first seemed to be a large, square-rigged sailing ship. In the haze, it cut a lovely figure, its 3 masts billowing with canvas. Unlike other U-boat commanders who sank such ships with reluctance, Schwieger was unmoved. He saw a target. U-20 turned toward the ship, and Schwieger's men loaded and aimed its deck gun. As Schwieger got closer, he saw that once again the light and haze had deceived him. The ship did have 3 masts, but it was only a small schooner. He signaled the vessel to stop. Although he had fired on ships many times without warning, here he returned briefly to cruiser rules. "As no danger existed for our boat in approaching," he wrote, "we made for the stern of the sailor." He ordered the schooner's captain and 4-man crew to abandon ship and bring its registry and cargo manifest over to U-20. The schooner proved to be the Earl of Latham out of Liverpool, carrying rocks from Limerick. It weighed all of 99 tons. As the schooner's crew began rowing away, Schwieger ordered his men at the gun to begin firing at the schooner's waterline. Despite its small size and decidedly non-buoyant cargo, the vessel proved a stubborn target. Shot after shot boomed across the sea and exploded against its hull. Schwieger's gun crew needed 12 shells to sink it. Several hours later, as dusk and fog gathered, Schwieger found another target. A steamship emerged from the fog, very near, too close to allow Schwieger to prepare an attack. He turned U-20 away to gain sea room, but kept the boat on the surface. The steamship stopped, apparently expecting an examination under cruiser rules. Outwardly, the vessel weighed about 3,000 tons, and seemed to be Norwegian, but Schwieger and his pilot, Lance, sensed something amiss. The markings were unusually high on the hull, and Schwieger suspected they might have been